Conscious Living and Power Radio. Hey there, it's Wendy. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate your time. Remember, you can always catch up with stuff on the blog, and actually, I switch it over to Wendy's Coffee House, and pretty much anything that happens here, I also duplicate and share on the Wendy's Coffee House. So the thing today is also going to be part of Wendy's Coffee House. I actually did an interview with Leslie earlier. Leslie Lupo is a near-death experiencer, and if you have not heard the story, you're not alone, because the book is coming out. It's been 20, 30 years in the making. Good stories always are. All right, so with this, the book, November 2018 is when it comes out, so I'm really, this is so fun because we get to do it ahead of everybody else for the most part. Remember, every breath is precious, and that's the name of the book. And Leslie, it took her a while to actually decide to write the book. She had a lot of prompting, but when you read the laundry list of people, and I mean laundry list of the names, people that you would recognize who are endorsing this book, you'll know why. The names: Dean Radin, Dr. Raymond Moody, Kenneth Ring, Irvin Laszlo, Susan Giesman, who's also a psychic and did some corroborating of Leslie's experience. Dr. Gary Schwartz does the foreword. This is an incredible story, and I'm really glad to introduce Leslie Lupo. Hey, Leslie.
Hello. Good morning.
You sound so normal.
Oh, you know I am.
The thing about this is, you know, the near-death experiences are fascinating because each person has such a unique and very personal encounter, and yet the bulk of it, the majority, it changes their life in a way that everything here is just kind of a fraction of what they experience in a near-death experience. And you mirror that as well. You said it when you were out. It was incredible the way that your mind, your body, the sounds were amplified, the vision was amplified. Let's go back, and what happened with your near-death experience?
Well, I got caught in the stampede of horses. I was helping to unsaddle some horses, and a couple ran down to the hay barn. I went down to get them, and I was wiggling between them, and all of a sudden they bolted. Now, about 15 seconds before they bolted, my mind or my consciousness, my essence, I like the way you say that, popped out and witnessed my death and took it in stride as like, okay, it's the end of a cycle. It's time to go home. This was just a way to discard the body so that the spirit could go, my immortal soul could go back upstairs, which is what I call heaven.
When you talk about that, though, the interesting thing was before anything even happened, you'd already popped out.
Yes. Yes. And I wondered if that happened to everyone.
Well, I think that's what's extraordinary is that, and I know, you know, each experience is different. I know some people who at the same time they're having, there's one guy that I interviewed at the same time he was having his heart attack. He was aware of the body failing, and he just stepped from that state into the non-corporeal state. And it was, you know, a very quick transition, but it wasn't it wasn't like he was standing there watching himself. It was as it was happening. So I think that's the interesting part about yours. You were almost like peeking around the corner.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny though. I had a lady share with me recently after hearing one of my lectures at the place I work, she went back and her mom had a heart attack and a stroke 4 months later. And as she lay in bed dying and moaning, even though she was on pain, this lady was telling her, I know you're not inside. I know you're in this room watching me and that you don't feel this pain. And suddenly on the back of her head, she could feel her hair getting mussed. And
yes,
that's what her mother always used to do to her. So those kind of stories, you know, I think a lot of people pop out of a painful experience and I didn't feel anything negative.
Well, and that's part of it too, is that, and I would say duality, the fact that you are present with the corporeal form and then in that essence form, the spirit form, and it really in a much greater conscious awareness of the state. I think for one thing, when you've had that experience, you appreciate more the totality of being able to even, you know, to contemplate, to visualize that state of, my gosh, we're more than just this body, this bag of bones. This, mm-hmm, this is mm-hmm. the real status where you were.
Yes, yes. And at the time I had the accident, I had no interest at all in anything spiritual. In fact, I was pretty antagonistic to anything spiritual. Didn't want a part of it, you know, had my fill of it. That was it. And then this happened. And so, you know, when people say, oh, it's just your imagination or it's what you believe, at that point, I was pure science and I was absolutely not interested. So if that was true, that's what I would have experienced. And yet I came into this world of such intense love and wonderful support. And it's like all the beautiful parts of the human beings, happy, you know, good qualities were there and none of the negative. That's what struck me first when I was upstairs, was I had no negative, you know, that fight or flight reflex that's in your brain. And yeah. you have that tension or fear or anything. None of the fear-based qualities of the human consciousness was present, and I could feel that they weren't there, and I could feel the joy that, you know, that brought. It was amazing.
I want to ask about the animals too, because you said you were caught up in a stampede. Did you have a sense of the emotions or of the essence of the animals, the horses that you were with?
Well, they were terrified because something spooked one of them, and then as a group, they ran. And they were, the one that my arm slid in through a stirrup up to my shoulder, so I was being dragged by this horse trying to get out of it mm-hmm. because I had horses on both sides and I was being crushed. And they were terrified. And the one that I was hanging on was kicking at me because he was angry and terrified. So yeah. there was a lot of that boiling energy that was around me when it was going on.
And at that point, I think you were just distant and overseer
right.
of that activity, just watching
right.
and letting, you know, and were you curious about how that was going to end?
You know, I didn't, because it probably took about 15, 20 seconds for me to die. And it was going so quickly. In one sense, if I close my eyes and I remember the visual, it's almost like watching it in slow motion. I was so shocked to be out of my body. I didn't do any processing. I just watched. But I could feel the peacefulness and I could feel the love already present in me, and I could also feel as if I was just watching it, like, you know, the coyote falls off the cliff when he's chasing the roadrunner and then a big boulder falls on his head. It wasn't comical, but it was very, I was very detached and peaceful with it, like, oh, this is just the way you take off your clothes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was like taking off a body girdle that was four sizes too small. And it's that sense of relief that I had that I was out of the body.
So when that happens, then you transition, and and reading the book and finding out that all of a sudden that world disappears.
Yes. And then I'm surrounded. It was like a fade out and a fade in overlapping. And I'm in this beautiful, thick, old looking, huge oak tree type forest with a beautiful little river running through it, and the amount of it was velvet, like flowers were everywhere, velvet moss, beautiful ferns. It was, but everything was lit from within. They almost looked a little translucent. I actually touched one because I thought, you know, is this a hologram? Am I in a hologram world?
Mm-hmm.
And so I touched one of the leaves and it moved when I touched it. I didn't go through it like you would a hologram. And so even if I was a hologram and that was a hologram, we would have not been able, I would have gone through it. So I was so enamored and overwhelmed by the light and the green, the particular shades of colors. They're so hard to translate. I've tried so many times because I also have a fine arts degree. I had a double major in college. I've tried so many times with paint and pencil and, you know, watercolor to try to paint what I saw. And it always comes out looking smarmy and cartoony. And it's not, you know, it's just phenomenally gorgeous. The colors are very saturated and rich.
With that, the sense of being somewhere, is this dimension present while we're alive? Or did you have that sensation? Because I know there's a... some people say that we're overlapping, like parallel universes or different dimensions. Did it have that feel to it?
Well, that's a very interesting question because the first thing I wondered as I switched dimensions to heaven, because it was not like I was going up into another area, but I wondered what kind of world surrounds us. You know, we don't see very much of all the light waves that are available. We don't hear all the sound waves that are available. We have such a tiny little framework. And I always think, I wonder if what it would be like to peek out on the other side or expand our wavelength to where we could encompass quite a bit more higher and lower frequencies. And the second thing, and when I was walking around, and I looked up, I noticed that it was as if my sky was the floor of another realm above it. Mm-hmm. And the person I was working with was named Raul. And I asked him, is there something else up there? And he said, oh, yes, there are other worlds. And it looked like a bubble kind of, I felt like we were in a bubble and there were other bubbles all around it. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, we go up there when we want, because at one point I almost felt like I could lift and go up there. And then he said, then we can turn around and come back down. Now, upstairs, it made perfect sense to me. When I was trying to make sense of it after I came back, I thought, gee, I wonder what he meant by that. Maybe I wish he was here. I could ask him, because a lot of things that I was told made perfect sense up there. And I come back and I go, So to me, I think there are realms. At one point, I was on a cliff looking down at a beach realm. It looked like a whole nother village. But on the edge of the horizon, I could see more of those kind of bubbles on bubbles. So I do believe there's many, many realms, which is why one person may go back upstairs and be a particle of light. You know, or a wave of energy, and other people maybe be, you know, are in completely different realms. The nice thing is that it's kind of like there's so many different ones, and yet there's a similarity of the shift of consciousness when we come back, and most of them are very enlightening, empowering, you know, experiences.
What I want to ask about too is that, when you're there, you transition and you go into an area where there's a table and other people are there. Who are the other people?
That was my soul group. That was the group I work with when I'm upstairs. We all kind of like work. We don't sit on a cloud and watch the earth. In fact, learning upstairs, education is as joyous and as sought out as vacation time is on Earth. It's like being on a perpetual vacation to be learning. Everything to me, if I could boil it down to one word, it would be everything is growing and expanding. And, you know, when it just seems that everything was geared towards expansion in that way, and bettering yourself and growing and evolving. So
when you talk with Raul and there was another Mina. Were they primary guides, or how do you explain that?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. They were the ones that were sitting on either side of me. Mm-hmm. And Mina is someone that I saw often as a child, and I thought she was a guardian angel. Rao, I'd never encountered in my childhood. Now, some of the beings, I could only see the ones closest to me because it was a kind of an oval table, and there was this huge energy bar wavy thing in the center, which is where they showed me certain things. Like, it was like a 3D movie, and I couldn't see the second half of the table, but I could see the ones that were sitting closest to me. And there was another man, Timo, that I would see from time to time as a child. So those were the primary ones, although Timo and I never spoke. It was just Rao and Mina. And I think I had an astrologer do an astrology for that particular date and time. Mm-hmm. And it kind of blew his mind because Rao is actually Sanskrit for the north node of the moon. And Mina is Sanskrit for Pisces. And the north node of the moon goes through Pisces once every like 20 years. And it just happened to be at that precise moment going through Pisces. So that's probably why those are the only two I talked with.
See, that is just fascinating. And then not only that, the fact that there were 11 people at the table, you would be 12. And if you're doing anything that's astrology related, the 12 is specific 12 number. Oh, yeah.
I know. I mean, when John Dennis did that astrology chart for me, it blew my mind because I did not expect, and it answered so many other questions that I had when I would sit and meditate and reflect on the experience. There were still things I didn't understand, like that deep V that I said to Saraswati, why did I come back now? And she drew this very deep V. And I thought, okay, that made sense to me upstairs. It did not make sense to me here. And then on the astrology chart, you have Jupiter and Venus, and right at the bottom, Pluto, which is Hades, and you get to go down into Hades and come back. You know, and I was like, wow.
Wow.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah. You can take that a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what was the most, for you, the most enlightening of that experience?
The most enlightening, I don't know. There were so many of them. I think the things that serve me the best coming back are the knowledge that the world is a one-room schoolroom, and understanding that everyone has a chosen curriculum, and that it's not my place to judge them. It's my place to find my peer group as far as life. And that was the biggest thing. It helps me to understand, because you could be talking to the CEO of a Fortune 500 company who's basically in third grade of soul development, and your busboy at dinner could be a PhD in soul development. So mm-hmm. that helped me a lot. The other thing was, when I came back, I really knew that all I have is right here, right now. I had kept waiting for something to happen. I had had a life with some troubles in it, and I couldn't shake them, and I realized that I had to do something about, I can't control what happens to me, but I can control how I react.
Yes.
And so a lot of wisdom, I began to really put the pieces together and recognize I had missed my spiritual connection. And then again, coincidentally, immediately after I came back, I start meeting all these deeply spiritual people, and I get right back into that spirituality that I had left so many years before when I was in college, due to a trauma then. And it was beautiful to go back into it and do my meditations and try to make sense out of it again with my logical mind, because I am a scientist. I study physics. I go to physics conferences. I love science. I also love spirit. And it's nice that you've got all these scientists now discovering God, you know, and discovering consciousness. And that's, you know, that inner divine that that we do have. It's becoming like kind of a grassroots thing right now. So it's a good time to be alive. That's all I can say.
Oh, I agree. I agree. There's so much happening right now that 30 years ago, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Absolutely not.
It would have been too far off the deep end and just completely somebody would thought we would have had a very, very vivid imaginations, which I do. But okay, so with this, the other thing too that I like, you, when you were a kid, you had premonitions, you had abilities, and that mm-hmm. was stifled. You, at one point, you said, mm-hmm. Can't do this. What happened with that?
It scared me. I saw a car accident a few minutes before it happened, and for some reason, I thought I did it. You know, I thought I had caused it, and I didn't talk to anybody about it. And so then I internalized it because I didn't want to do something wrong, and I just shut it off. I closed myself to it. When I went away to college, it was interesting because I was in New Mexico, and I kept bumping into medicine people and shamans and a Wiccan high priestess, and they kept saying to me, why do you have your light turned off? And so I went back into it and started working with them. Then I had a major trauma, and I felt I should have seen it. So I went back into my logical brain and shut it down again. And then I couldn't do that again, which is interesting because the first spiritual person I met afterwards said the same thing to me. She said, why do you have your light turned off? So I thought, well, okay, that gave me chills. I thought, okay, listen, Leslie. And you know, it's funny because spirit talks to us all the time. We just don't listen. You know,
okay,
it's kind of like,
that you also work with that, though. That's how you help people.
Yes.
And so I know we're going to take a break. I didn't want to get into it because I want you to explain how that works a little bit more. But that I think is fascinating too, is because, and a lot of people describe it as the monkey mind, and you do too, that we have this constant chatter about everything. Yes. Oh, I should dress better. Or I wish I had done this with my family. I should change jobs. That wasn't good enough. This won't be enough. All those, that constant just gobbledygook that runs on a little autopilot tape. That's the hardest thing to shut down. And instead we shut down that spiritual component, that other thing that we're not quite sure about. And that is something that I think is the hardest thing to break, is to shut out that chatter that is self-destructive. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Perfect.
So when we come back, we're going to take a break. I want you to go back into how you were able to turn that around after this experience, because we're going to get to the moment where you wake up and everybody still is not quite ready to get with what you're talking about. And
okay.
Then the other thing too, about, there's an animal in this, the story of you and the dog. And these are other ways of thinking about the present and our interactions and the things that happen to us. If we could reframe it into a way where it's helpful rather than hurtful. And I think I've got 5 minutes here, so we can probably talk about that dog, because that was a very powerful experience for you real quick.
Well, I was walking up in the mountains with my dog, and I was in college, and he stepped into a leg trap, and when I tried to go help him, I was moving very slowly. He turned on me and attacked me when my hand got near his leg to push the button on the leg trap. And I jumped away, and a man heard the noise, came running through, and did what he should have done, covered Orion's head with his jacket and pushed the button, and my dog was fine. He ripped my jacket, but I wasn't angry with him because I knew what motivated him. And eventually, that became a very vivid recall and memory, so that when I would be around people that were negative or angry or overreacting, I could just look at them and just in my mind say, wow, here's their bear trap. And it you don't take it personally. I mean, people tell you don't take it personally. How? Even that book had, that book, Four Agreements, had a whole chapter on it, but they never say how. Focus on what's their core motivation. Focus on the fact that they're hurting. We either come from love or fear. That's it. Every action, reaction comes from one of two places, love or fear. Is this a loving thing to say? No. Wow, here's their bear trap.
Yes.
It's so easy to begin to focus on and step back from it and say, wow, I'm sorry that this is their pain. You can feel empathy for their pain, even though they're attacking you. You don't personalize it because it's got nothing to do with you. They were looking for some place to transfer their anger or pain. And when Orion was biting my shoulder, he didn't feel his trap, did he? No. Mm-hmm. So
no. He was taking action. Okay. So when we come back, this is what happened, because you had to get beyond. This is 30 years ago when people didn't talk about this stuff, and people who did weren't very popular. So let's come back. You were waking up, returning from this experience, this transcended experience, and trying to figure out which way was up and trying to tell everybody this is what happened. And everybody wasn't very receptive. Matter of fact, that hurtful stuff was right there front and center. And so the recovery, not only from the physical stuff, was also a psychological recovery as well, because this was mind-boggling, and some of it to other people was absolutely frightening that you could believe this. What was wrong with you? Okay. So Leslie Lupo is my guest. Near-death experience, fantastic memories from this. Remember, every breath is precious is the name of the book. Coming back in a few on Empower Radio.
It takes 12 years to create a graduate. It takes about the same time to create a dropout. The difference between a child becoming one or the other could be you. Studies prove that reading to a child regularly dramatically improves reading skills. And kids who read well by third grade are four times as likely to graduate. So United Way is calling for 1 million volunteers over the next 3 years. We're asking you to step up, make a pledge, tutor a child who needs help, mentor a kid who needs someone on their side, volunteer to read to children, make a difference. Because when a child advances, we all advance. Entire communities improve. The path to success or failure starts long before graduation day. And the difference between a graduate and a dropout could be you. Be a reader, tutor, or mentor. Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge. Go to liveunited.org now. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Okay, Simon, what are you wearing right now?
Nothing.
That's right. And what do people normally wear?
Clothes.
Exactly. So now Mommy's going to teach you how to dress yourself. Clothes keep us warm, they look good, and if we go out without them, the neighbors will talk. So it's important to know how to get dressed. Here's how it's done. Underwear always comes first, name tag at the back, then pants, then shirt. Get the first button in the right hole, or you have to start all over. If you're wearing a tie, it goes over, round, round, through, and pull tight. Tuck your shirt into your pants and zip up your fly. Socks go in first, then shoes, right on right, left on left. With shoelaces, just take the ends, cross them over, switch the loops. The rabbit goes down the hole, pull tight, and you're left with bunny ears.
I love bunnies.
Good to know. Now remember, spots don't go with stripes, socks don't go with sandals, and if you've tucked in your shirt, wear a belt. Got it? Why are your pants on your head?
Most parenting is hard to do in just 2 minutes. But spending just 2 minutes twice a day making sure they brush their teeth is easier and could help save them from a lifetime of tooth pain. For fun 2-minute videos to watch while brushing, visit 2min2x.org. That's 2min2x.org. A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ag Council.
Today might be the day I drop out of school. Today could be the last day I try. My parents alone can't stop me. My friends can't even stop me. But you might be able to. With United Way, you could tutor me, be my mentor, or volunteer to just read with me. If someone had helped me earlier, I might not be struggling. And studies prove that kids who read well by third grade are more likely to graduate. There are tons of ways people like you can help kids like me stay in school. And United Way is calling for you to be one of them. Because it takes 12 years to create a graduate. It takes about the same time to create a dropout. And the difference between me becoming one or the other could be you. Make me a success, not a statistic.
Take the pledge to volunteer now at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett at Power Radio. My guest, Leslie Lupo, near-death experiencer. And we're going to get... There's so much stuff to cover here that I can't cover it all. The interesting thing about the astrology, that is fantastic. You also had a psychic do a reading, and she picked up on stuff that nobody could know. And then you've also been working with people in the field who are studying the after-death and near-death issues. And so you've collected a whole contingent of people who can help you make sense of and corroborate the experience. But at the very beginning, when you first came back and opened your eyes and came out of the coma, the world wasn't quite ready to hear what you had to say. What was that like?
Well, I know they meant well, but at the end of the day, it was very traumatic because I knew what had happened, just like you're sitting in a chair right now and no one can come in and say to you after you get up and leave the room, oh, that was a dream. You were never sitting in that chair listening or talking. I knew it was real. It was ultra real. There's no doubt in my mind that it was not a dream or hallucination. Yet the more I persisted in trying to share such an extraordinary, blessed, loving event that I was fine and that I chose to come back, the more I got shut down to the point where the doctor threatened to pump me up with so many drugs I would not know if it was day or night. And that terrified me because he could have. Even
that would make you shut up. I mean, just have somebody with that authority and that power to say, this is what will happen if you don't cease and desist.
Right. And even when I try to share it, they'd look away. My mother would look away, my mother-in-law, my husband, everyone would just kind of look down and look away. And I felt so awkward. And then after that shock jock therapy he did, I did shut up. I didn't talk about it anymore because I wasn't going to get into trouble. And then even immediately afterwards, within my family, when I was out of the hospital and I felt out of the doctor's clutches, I still tried a few times and was told point blank, do we need to call the doctor? And so again, shut it down, And it literally followed me for about 10 or 12 years where people would make comments. Even after my divorce, if I'd meet people who I'd known before then, they were, she has psychological damage from her head injury when I didn't. And so it was difficult to get past that and cause me not to talk about it for a very, very long time. Even with my spiritual friends, I wouldn't talk about it because in a spiritual group, I had been singled out and thrown out and told that it was a hallucination. And I just figured, keep it to myself. And I just put it on the back burner. I remembered it in meditation. And that's basically what I did. I thought, something's off here. And I went into a very nice realm of getting deeper and deeper into meditation. I'd go to India. I'd go to ashrams around America. When my kids were with their father, I would just sit and chill and say, okay, what the heck was this all about? And what can I do with it? How can I live a happier life with this new information?
See, that is phenomenal. And see, to me, what you got was a PhD in don't take it personal.
Yes. Oh, you're right. You're right.
That's difficult.
I had to.
And that what I, when people who've had these experiences, and mine was a spiritually transformative experience, an STE, which there wasn't a name for it when I had it. There was no name for the things I experienced as a kid, but I also knew I needed to keep my mouth shut. That part I did know. And even with people who would have been receptive, I wasn't sure how to put it into concrete terms. It didn't have a frame of reference that made sense. So these kinds of experiences test us and challenge us. And when you're talking about that with the dog, that it wasn't personal. The dog was just reacting out of an innate survival instinct of pain, ow, make it go away, and projecting that on you. And then somebody came in with the little, like a pillowcase, you know, a cover, a jacket, a coat. And then all of a sudden things became normal again once the trap was released. We are confronted with people every day who have these kinds of pains and issues. And there we are on the other end of the table going, but it's not me. I'm not causing this. And your story shows people how real that can be and how difficult it can be to get out of being the victim or the person who's being projected upon with all that trauma. This is, I think, one of the things you're here to help people with.
Yeah, it's a real, it's something that people have to really decide. You know, change is very difficult for humans, and really thank God for it. If we were high risk takers, we would be extinct. You know, one of the things I've noticed within myself and within my clients that I work with, I've noticed that we get to a wall that's scary because that's change. And if I let go of this job or this relationship or this family member or this belief, then I'm kind of like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. I'm going from black and white into color, and I'm not sure I can handle that. And so it has to be the pain of staying still gets bigger than the pain of change before we'll make that jump. And that's actually not a bad thing. I really try to tell people, don't worry about it, because you can't go willy-nilly jumping on every single possible theory. You want to wait and investigate. And when you're ready, you will make the change. It takes a lot of courage to let things go that are hurting us, to take off that bear trap. We're the only one that can take off our own bear trap. So it's not just noticing the bear trap in someone else. Once we go through that stage, then we get to say, okay, where are my bear traps? Every reaction or action I do, is this coming from pain? Look at me, I'm worthwhile, I have an opinion. Or is this coming from love? What's your feelings about things? Selfishness is a younger soul. Selflessness is an older soul. And so as you're selfless, you begin to gravitate and attract more of your own peer group so that you have friends that are true friends. They love you, you know, as you are, without trying to fix you or change you.
That's the thing that happened with you when you have, this is back to the medical part of it, the scans of your brain and what damage you went through. And the doctors at the time were saying, she's done. She's gone. Not much longer for this earth. And so when people see those right now, the x-rays, and say, holy cow. And yet you don't have the residual. You don't have the injury. That is a miracle.
It's a couple of miracles, because when I first came in, they didn't do anything. I had broken bones in my shoulder, in my hip, and in my backbone, fractures. And they didn't mess with them because they figured I was going to die. And whatever part of the ICU I was in, thank goodness I didn't need any oxygen, because they didn't even hook me up at first to food, because they didn't think I'd last 24 hours. You know, they put glucose in you and all that stuff, but they told my husband, she won't make it. She'll be dead within 48 hours. Get her family notified. And then I didn't. Then I had 4 grand mal seizures. Back in the ICU, you know, it moved me out of ICU when I didn't die. Then I had the seizures. The subdural hematoma went down deeper into the brainstem, you know, and they're just like, okay, this is it. She's gone. Contact her family again. And then I didn't. And then I came out of the coma. They said I wouldn't. Then I wasn't 4 years old, like they said I would be the rest of my life. So all those little hurdles, I just kept jumping over.
Okay. Did they tell you about the fine print like that when you were in your non-corporeal state? Did they say, oh, by the way, you're going to have a few challenges?
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yes. Mina was very clear. If I went back, because when I finally decided to go back, we looked at both options, what I would do if I stayed up there and what I would do if I came back, when I said yes, it was almost as if they were, okay, now we're going to argue against that. Here's what the problems are going to be. And, you know, this is so funny because they said it's going to take you a few years to get back into yourself again. And I'm thinking, a few years, what's that? You know, I'll push, it's like a minute. And so when I came back, I can remember several times laying in my bed sobbing, thinking, oh my gosh, when is this going to end?
You know? How long is a year?
Exactly. Minute by second, you know, and it was very, very, it was very interesting. And one of the most weirdest things is when the memories come back, because you are exactly where you were when they happened. And you don't have that buffer of the wisdom and the growth and the, you know, all, you're just right back where you were when you have, if whether it's a happy memory or a sad memory, you're right back in it. And you've got to experience it again in all its rawness, you know, which is, was like being super glued into a roller coaster.
Ooh. Okay, that doesn't sound quite so fun.
No, that was, the funny ones were great. The unfunny ones, the painful memories coming back, because it literally took me about a year, a little over a year, to get the majority of my memories back. And it wasn't fun sometimes, and it was hysterically funny other times, you know.
Well, and you had children, and so that was part of it. At the very beginning, you forgot about any attachments whatsoever. You were free, and you were that, you know, that lovely, floaty, iridescent essence. And then the other things that kind of kept you and might have motivated you to say, well, I'll go back and give it a little bit more time. The children were part of it. Was that difficult?
Yes. You know, at one point we talked and I asked Raul, I said, why did they pick me? They knew I was going to die. And he said, because they also knew you had a choice. And because he was showing me in that energy ball my children. And I was watching them with, and I love them, but it wasn't the grizzly bear protect my children love that I have in my human body. It was the, as you know, the very etheric understanding that at the end of the day, everything was still going to be okay. Yeah. And it wasn't like a pressure thing or coercion. It was something that they just showed me. This is what you didn't schedule. I was supposed to die in college, and I didn't. I jumped my contract and stayed. Mm-hmm. And so now everything I was doing was kind of like, you know, writing it as I'm going. And I had children I didn't sign up for, but came to me. And it was like, what do you want to do about this? This is also a factor. And I probably would not have come back except for the children. If I didn't have children, there's no way I would have come back. It's so nice upstairs. Yeah.
Well, the part of this, though, that is so fascinating is, too, that after all these years and having had the door slammed in your face every which way from Sunday, now the invitations are there that say, you know what? You have something that we value and that we need and that you can contribute because you've been there, done that, and seen it from the side where the doctor says, shut up or we're going to drug you so you'll never remember anything again.
Hmm. Yeah, so that's true.
That part, you had to be there in that situation to be able to bring the knowledge and the, you know, the testimonial of this is what it's like to be in that situation when nobody will hear you and they threaten to drug you into oblivion. And that can't happen. That can't happen anymore. Or it doesn't need to happen anymore.
And I think that's actually, in my opinion, a benefit of going through what I did with the doctor. If I had had a Dr. Welby or whatever his name is, if I had had an ideal doctor that was loving and kind and supportive, like I found later on when I switched hospitals, I wouldn't have had the ability to learn, you know, to know what not to do. And his antagonism caused me to go more inside and find out the answers myself. I had to figure out what happened. You know, that was something that because I'm also scientific, I just was like, no, how can I prove this? And it led me into the journey where I started bumping into all these spiritual people. And then all the people that are doing the 40 years of research now that are being published and all that. So if I hadn't had those knocks on the head when I first came out of it, I might just be still floating along, you know, baking brownies for my grandchildren instead of being a spokesperson for the people that are still being told that you are insane.
And that's what I wanted to get into, too, because the way you teach, if you're listening, the website, it's LeslieJoanLupo.com, and Light Your Path is the part that I'm looking at to cultivate a life of self-worth. What you say is that, you know, the love you attract mirrors the love you feel for yourself. So a lot of this has to do with self-esteem and self-awareness and self-protection. And in so many ways, just a way of knowing that you have value instead of discounting your own worth, then you bring that knowing you have value, then the people who come into your life have that same kind of energy. And that's a lesson right there, is how to identify that and how to bring your own essence front and center to the equation. And it took you 30 years.
Right. You know, it's interesting because when my daughter was little, I used to say to her, how come I love you so much? And she would say to me, because I'm a good girl. And she was a good child. But something in me kept going, ding, 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 wrong, wrong, wrong. And all of a sudden I looked at her, I said, no, I love you because you're here. Children innately feel they have to earn love. And that's what we have to let go of. You deserve love as you are right this minute. You don't have to change and be a different person or perfect yourself. Think about being perfect. If you're perfect, Wendy, you've got nothing left to learn. You've got, that's scary.
I know I have to check out. That's not fair.
You have no one
leave.
You can speak to. Right, exactly. You have no one you can talk to because you're the teacher in the classroom syndrome. And who are you going to go hang out with? So perfection doesn't exist because that stifles. If the things are perfect, there's no more growth. The whole core of consciousness is growth. Everything in the universe is growing. It's not like a sequoia at 3,000 years goes, you know, this is tall enough. Every year they grow. Every year, life is, and consciousness is expanding and growing. And that's part of it, is learning that as I am, I'm worthy of love, and getting over that. And I take any 2 or 3-year-old and say, how come your mommy loves you so much? And 4-year-old, and they're going to say the same thing, because I'm a good boy or girl. And it's like, no, you're loved because you're here. And I used to say that to them. I love you when you're good. I love you when you make mistakes. I love you because you're here.
I think that's a challenge in so many ways, because we have all of our own expectations and our projections and our fantasies of what love is and what it should be and what society puts on it. Instead of if you just think, I love hummingbirds. I love tomatoes. I love trees. I don't have any expectation. I see the image. And I also have, in some way, shape, or form, a belief that a tree represents something. But there's no person, there's no expectation that it has to be a certain kind of tree. It's just a tree. Mm-hmm. And so there's something about it that gives it much more room to be full of potential instead of me trying to make it be a certain type of energy or a certain type of tomato. Does that make sense?
Right. Yes.
It's hard to explain.
No, you did an excellent job. I mean, I thought that was very clear. The thing is about feeling lovable is the love that goes on in intimate love, which is the most vulnerable. When you have 2 adults that are sexually engaged in a deep relationship of love, that's the most vulnerable place you can be. Yeah. And that takes a lot of courage. That's why I always say marriage is for adults only. And you're not supposed to be changing them. You're supposed to be working on yourself. It's like being best friends, best lovers the rest of your life, but it takes work. and selflessness, you know, and caring, and they each have to bring the same percentage. So often in my practice, I will see a very tipped over relationship where one's the parent and one's the child instead of two adults. But what you're talking about is going into a very high level of bringing that immense consciousness, spiritual love to that ability to be in a committed, you know, relationship. That's what makes it so magical. That's what makes it so exciting and brings you the highest level of love, you know, that that's capable between two people. It's deeper and more vulnerable even than a mother with a newborn child.
Well, and that is that the adult thing, because you bring to it the expectation of, is this person going to be here for me even if I'm sick, even if I have moments of doubt, even if I change jobs, even if I lose certain aspects of my health? You know, those kinds of things, as you say, the tree doesn't stop growing. Well, people don't stop evolving in their own sense of emotions, their ability to we don't have the same look our entire life.
No.
All of that is change, and it's scary, and it's challenging. And to know that your partner is going through all of these things too, and is this going to stay? Will this be here? And I think part of it's just showing up, and there's a love that goes with that. Thank God you showed up for me. I don't care about anything else except the fact that I value your presence and your ability to overlook my flaws.
And you know, a lot of that, Wendy, we can see in advance. You know, I do these workshops, and most of the clients I work with at Canyon Ranch, we always focus on one thing. How many red flags did I fly past in whatever relationship that crashed down around my head, whether it's love or friendship or family or work? We get all these red flags that are like dead end. And the key word is respect. The more I know someone and the more I watch how they handle adversity in their life, how they handle commitments to production of whether it's grades when you're in school, in college, or they handle their business affairs, how they handle their obligations, how they look at life. Are they always on the negative, defensive, like Eeyore with a cloud over their head? The more I know someone, the more I should be respecting them. Yeah. Respect is supposed to be growing. And if you look at back in your life and then you say, listen, did I respect the way they walked their talk in their personal life and their professional life? Were they authentic? No, we fall in love with potential.
Yeah.
Not fact.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. You got to take them as they are or walk away. If you open the box and it says assembly required, put it back on the shelf. You know, it's literally just... don't go there. You can love them
unconditionally. Yes.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, you are always in contact with your guides. And
yes.
We talked about it earlier. We just kind of teased it. How do you know? How are you able to separate that soul message from the personality message, from that little tiny voice, from the larger voice within? How do you tell?
How that happens? Are you there?
I'm here. Yeah, I know it's a tough question.
Let's see. How that happens is this. It's done mostly in, again, meditation. If you look at the mind, it's the same as having 14 different radio stations on, you know, at high volume. One of those radio stations is your intuition. Your intuition is always going to be taking you on the correct pathway. It's a gut feeling of knowing. It's not thinking, it's knowing. So you have to learn how to still the mind, and you have to be able to calm things down before you will be able to find that inner wisdom that we all have. And when you can delay reaction 2 or 3 seconds, that's why our grandparents said count to 10. If you can just pause and say, is this love or fear coming at me? Fear, oops, there's a bear trap. And turn around and give them quiet, I call it sacred silence back, we don't jump in, you're able to get in touch with that channel to God. I mean, you all have a direct line to God or the divine or creator. Everyone calls it different, the unmanifest. We all have that into our guides. Your guides are there to help you. Everyone
has. We got 30 seconds.
So just learn, still the mind and listen. It's just listening within.
The book is called Remember, Every Breath is Precious. Author Leslie Joan Lupo.
Thank you.
If you're listening, check it out. Check out her website, LeslieJoanLupo.com, and read the book. All right? You can connect. It's just a matter of listening. See ya.